Hello and welcome to the first session of the 2012 NEWH Green Voice webinar series. My name is Gary Gola. I'm an architect with Sarah Architects of Portland, Oregon. I chair the Events and Forums Subcommittee of NEWH's Green Hospitality Committee. Our group has assembled the sessions being held today and tomorrow. We have a great lineup of sessions and speakers, so I hope you will join us for all of the program. It took a big effort by the committee, NEWH staff, and our speakers to deliver these sessions, so a big thanks goes out to all of them. During the session, if you have any questions, please type them into the comments area. There will be time for the speakers to address your questions at the end of the session. To get our first session started, which is Metatrends in Sustainability, Shaping Our Future, I would like to introduce Clark Brockman. Clark is Sarah Architects' principal dedicated to sustainability and is a champion for energy-efficient, climate-responsive design throughout the built environment. He is a passionate advocate and a facilitator who has led Sarah's continuing evolution in the fast-growing arena of high-performance buildings and district-scale systems. Clark is the past chair of the Cascadia Region Green Building Council, as well as a founding and current board member of the International Living Futures Institute. He speaks nationally and internationally on the impact of the built environment on climate change, and he serves as a green building policy advisor to multiple cities and counties, as well as to multiple members of Oregon's legislature and members of Oregon's federal delegation.
Thank you. This is Clark, and I'm pleased to be joined by two of my favorite colleagues in the green building world, Mark Frankel and Tom Lent. Mark Frankel is the technical director for the New Buildings Institute. And NBI develops programs and policy, training and research on high-performance buildings and energy efficiency for organizations all over the country. Currently, Mark is involved in national coalitions to improve building performance feedback, market adoption strategies for deep energy retrofits, and in the development and implementation of innovative codes and programs focused on building performance outcome and benchmarking. Mark has been consulting on energy efficiency and sustainable design for over 20 years. His work in this period has encompassed a broad range of technical topics, including lighting and daylighting, passive and high-performance mechanical systems, commissioning, energy modeling, and site design. Tom Lent has over 30 years of experience with energy and environmental issues, primarily focused on the health and environmental impact of buildings, materials, and energy. He's helped coordinate development of the Green Guidelines for Healthcare, Lead for Healthcare, and the Sustainable Bioplastic Guidelines with a focus on material toxicity issues. And he sits on a variety of other standard settings committees for indoor air quality, green chemistry, and healthy building design. Tom has co-authored a wide range of studies of the comparative health of environmental impacts of floorings, plastics, and other building materials. So with that, we're going to dive into today's talk, which is entitled Sustainability Metatrends, and I would tell you that our group has decided to narrow that a bit. One of the biggest trends that's facing all of us in the coming years is going to be the trend of transparency. We're seeing a growing push towards transparency in many, many things, from actual building energy use to the ingredients in our products, the toxicity of those ingredients and the health impacts, the carbon implications of the energy we use, et cetera. This is a big movement that's happening, and yet my sense is, and many sense, is that the entire built environment industry really doesn't know it's coming. So first, I'm going to do a little bit of background about why all of this matters so much. Why do we talk about buildings so much in the context of climate and energy use and toxicity and human health? Many of the reasons are fairly straightforward, even though I don't believe they're yet widely known. 40% of all the CO2 emissions in the United States is dedicated to buildings, 40% of total raw materials use, 30% of our total waste stream is tied to buildings, and 14% of our potable water consumption. These are big, big numbers. Another one that I think most people don't know is that buildings are a bigger contributor towards greenhouse gas emissions, that 40% number that I mentioned earlier, than either the transportation sector or the industrial sector. And this is not a commonly understood statistic, but it is absolutely true. So we really need to pay attention to buildings. They're actually the low-hanging fruit for us in terms of combating the issues we have around energy and climate change. So to punctuate this a little bit more on energy use, Buildings are 39% of total energy use or total energy throughput in America, compared to transportation at 29%, industry at 32%. Of that, almost three-quarters of all the electricity use in America is tied to buildings, 27% industry. Again, I don't think these are widely understood numbers. So another way to look at it is in terms of our building stock. So if you imagine this gray cube as representing all of the built square footage in America, roughly 250 billion square feet of buildings. And then you imagine in the next 20 years, we will demolish roughly one-fifth of that, down to 200 billion. Of the 200 billion square feet, we will remodel upwards of 150 million and add an additional 200 million. What this means is that the value proposition in front of us is in the next 20 years, we will touch over three-quarters of all of the building stock in America, and we have big decisions in front of us about how we touch it and what we do to it. And this meta trend of transparency that coming towards us is going to have huge impacts on this, and it's going to actually change the way we work. Another thing that's changing the way we work, as many of you may know, is the growing importance around green certification systems. This is a continuum diagram that Sarah created to just help understanding all the different systems that have been cropping up. Obviously, LEED stretches from better than code all the way up to very extraordinary performance at LEED Platinum. Beyond LEED Platinum, we have more and more projects that are now pursuing, in particular, net zero energy, but there are also net zero water projects cropping up. And then there's the Living Building Challenge, which I will talk about in a minute. But these are all these green standards, and there are many others. These have been changing the way we work, but all of these green standards, with the exception of the Living Building Challenge, have really been predictive in nature. And what we're moving towards is a whole different world. If we want to dive a little deeper in that, this is actually a study that Mark's organization, the New Buildings Institute, did on the actual energy performance of LEED-certified buildings. It's interesting, the study came out a few years ago and caused quite a hubbub. And as with so many things, it got a lot of its validity and importance got lost in the noise. But what I would draw people's attention to is there were over 100 buildings that were studied with their energy use, actual energy performance, as compared to their LEED energy model. And what the graph really tells us is very few buildings are performing to the model. But what got lost in the noise is there are many buildings that are outperforming their energy model, and there are as many buildings that are underperforming in their energy model. So as with so many things, all models are not correct, but some models are valuable. And what we found is that the LEED energy model to date has not yet proven to be as valuable as it could be, but clearly, the effort of working towards green buildings has created improved buildings, which was demonstrated by this study. So where we're moving now is we're moving to a world of actual performance, and I'm only going to do a brief introduction here. Mark is going to go into much more detail around this, but the notion of actual performance is something that is coming, and I don't believe anyone in the built environment industry, including the hospitality industry, is really focusing on this yet. One of the standards that is built around actual performance is the Living Building Challenge, and I hope if any of you are not familiar with it that you follow the links to this and go read about it more in depth, but I'm just going to give a brief introduction. The Living Building Challenge is really based on the notion that buildings are like plants and flowers, and they are based in a very specific location, in a very specific climate, and yet plants are able to harvest all their energy and water. They're adapted to wherever they are. They operate completely cleanly, and they provide a lot of value back. So why have the Living Building Challenge? It was clear that LEED was a powerful tool. It was, in effect, it is still the on-ramp for the entire green building movement, but it wasn't providing a clear answer about where are we going. What does the end game look like? And so the Living Building Challenge is really trying to start to answer a very complicated question of what is the future of really sustainable buildings and sustainable built environments. And the big differences between LEED is that You don't have discretionary choice. I mean, from LEED is the Living Building Challenge. You don't have discretionary choices of the points you pursue. There are 20 imperatives. You need to hit all of them, and they're not optional. And the second one is that all of your certification will be based on actual rather than modeled or anticipated performance, and that's really the theme of today's discussion. This focus on actual performance is also going to drive us towards much greater transparency. Finally, here's a list of the 20 imperatives, and again, I encourage people to dig deeper into the Living Building Challenge if this sounds interesting. So one of the subjects that I think many architects, and as an architect I feel comfortable to say this, that we don't like to talk about is what's challenging about the way our buildings use resources isn't the buildings themselves, but it's those pesky things inside the buildings, which are the people. It's really a challenge to model the way we think people will use buildings, and that has been one of the big, big challenges. But I also think the industry hasn't done a very good job of looking at what the actual way we use buildings, what impacts that has on all of our bottom line, including operational costs, which are huge, huge issues for the hospitality industry. There are beginning trends in this. There are 5 cities that have required energy use reporting on at least some of their building stock. So if you're wondering if this is gaining traction in the policy world, the answer is definitively yes. In Europe, it has more traction, and I know Mark is going to go into a little more detail on this, but there are energy use reporting labels being devised. These are coming. Be prepared to have your buildings start to demonstrate what their actual energy use is. Another area of transparency is around materials, and really the focus on green materials is rapidly zeroing in on the notion of human health. There are a lot of other issues around what's inside our materials, one of them being embodied energy, and so transparency around what's inside our materials has many aspects, but right now the piece that's really gaining traction nationally is the notion around human health. There are a variety of things that are in our buildings that are actually accumulating in our bodies that we don't know about. They're currently unregulated for a variety of reasons. Tom's going to go into great detail on this. The Living Building Challenge, one of its other components is that it actually has a red list of 13 substances that are actually ruled out from being inside buildings. Tom will go into this more in more detail, but it's been interesting. The whole notion of red lists or lists of things we don't want in our buildings, there are many of them out there. Tom will tell you about them, but this hasn't been a way to actually create market transformation. So we've been moving more towards getting the industry to tell us what's in them. There have been lots of ad hoc efforts. I'm showing you Sarah's questionnaire that we've been sending manufacturers, but there are new answers out there that Tom's going to talk about. So now I'm going to hand it over to Mark and let him tell you a lot more about what's happening in the world of actual energy use reporting.
Thanks very much, Clark, and thanks for having me in this webinar. I'm going to go over some of the things Clark talked about in a little more detail, and then we'll take questions at the end in case anything we talk about generates need for more specifics. So, first of all, if we look at the graph that Clark showed of buildings versus transportation and industry energy use, if you look moving forward at the business as usual projection, it's sort of a steady increase in energy use, and actually what we've been the big we are talking about is a pretty substantial change in that slope. And, basically all the building organizations, AIA, ASHRAE, USGBC, Conference of Mayors, a group of governors, et cetera, has set goals of substantial reductions in carbon from the building sector by 2030. And the slope of that goal is very, very steep. So we are talking about really major changes in the way buildings use energy and the way we do business in the building industry, the building sector, both new and existing. And so I really want you to understand that we are not talking about business as usual moving forward if we're trying to achieve these goals, and policies and codes are moving towards driving a relatively steep change in building energy use. So in the hotel industry, there's a bunch of things being started on benchmarking or determining, how much energy you use in your facility and what the impacts are. And there's a lot of different ways to look at that, and that actually leads to some confusion. But just to give you an example, on the graphs here, you see the top is hotel energy intensity, and this is measured in megajoules per room night. So this is based on number of rooms, And you can see, you know, the darker color is more intensity of energy use. And, you know, the colder climates use more heating energy in this graph, whatever. But the other thing that's interesting is that if you convert that to carbon, the carbon impact of those buildings is different. And you see that, the same data generates a different carbon impact depending on what you measure. So it's really important to decide what you're measuring and what you're trying to achieve. And in this case, the carbon impact changes because of the electrical grid. That is, whether the electricity being generated is coal, is coal-fired, or hydropower-fired, or nuclear, or gas, or whatever. And so that's really sort of outside the scope of the hotel, but yet it represents an impact of your operation in this category. And then, of course, energy is a big part of the hospitality industry's bottom line. It's the fastest-growing cost for the hotel industry. The average cost nationally is over $2,000 per guest room per year for energy costs alone, and nationally represents 6% of total operating costs going up. So another way that this is benchmarked is what we call energy use intensity, and that's a measure of energy use per square foot of building area. And so in the graph at the bottom, you can see the bottom axis, the x-axis, is from 0 to 250 kBTU per square foot per year. And, of course, the more energy you use, conceivably the more inefficient your building is. And those low-energy buildings are very efficient, and the high-energy buildings are very inefficient at first glance at this chart. But what you have to realize is that these are not the same building in different places. These are very different buildings. They vary by size, by climate. Climate has an impact on energy use, of course, size. If you think about overall building size, of course, a larger building is going to use more energy. And this energy use per square foot tries to normalize size. So it doesn't matter how big your hotel is. It matters how much energy per square foot you're using in this context. So this graph takes the size factor out of the equation, but it doesn't take anything else out of this equation. So whether or not the facility has dining facilities, the kitchen, the swimming pool, conference facilities, and the kinds of system, those all are not accounted for here. So you could expect that hotels without conference facilities or swimming pools are more likely to be on the left side of this graph, and hotels with big kitchens, swimming pools, conference facilities, et cetera, more intensive energy uses are more likely to be on the right side. But then within that, there's a whole range of efficiency opportunities for improvement. So because it's sort of hard to sort out the comparing apples to apples, whether you have a conference center, swimming pool, or not, there's some normalization criteria to go into this. I already told you that size is taken out of the equation here if you go by square foot. And the most common benchmarking tool is Energy Star. Energy Star has a rating system for hotels as well. And it's also important to recognize that Energy Star is a rating of building energy use when the building is actually operating. So it's been operating for a year before you get an Energy Star score. So this represents not just the building design, which is what we see in energy models, but also how it's used, how it's operated, how effectively it's managed, et cetera. And, of course, in Energy Star, the higher your score, the better. And this is probably the most common benchmark in the U.S. that people understand in terms of comparing buildings. Okay. So if we look at how hotels use energy, it actually varies pretty substantially. And in looking around, I saw quite a bunch of different analyses of this, depending on climate and other factors. This is a good example from California. California has been at the forefront of energy efficiency for decades, both in terms of stringent codes and careful attention to performance, and I'm sure any of you who build facilities in California recognize how stringent their codes are, but also they do a lot of work tracking and gathering information about those. So there's really a lot of good data out of California. And in the California market, you see that the biggest single end use for energy is HVAC, heating, cooling, heating, ventilating, air conditioning, and then water heating and lighting, the next two big ones. If you look at Florida, for example, it's almost all cooling. It's a huge chunk of energy goes to cooling, which would fit in the HVAC category, and almost none for heating, of course. Whereas in Chicago or Minnesota or whatever, it's mostly heating, very little cooling, et cetera. So you can imagine that the climate impacts this, but also the characteristics of the building, the physical characteristics, whether it's efficient or not efficient, impact this, and, of course, the uses, as I mentioned. So this is a general guide, and it's important to know in any given facility how your building is using energy if you're going to start addressing what the big opportunities are for improvement. But the other thing about this is, as you look at this, it seems like this is about the physical characteristics of the building. We've got a, you know, we've got a central heating and cooling system that's using energy. We've got lighting that's using energy, water heating. And you think about it as design features of the efficiency or lack of efficiency of the building. And so another way to look at that is this, and don't bother reading this, but this is a long list of things that impact building energy. And this is mostly about office buildings. The list is a little different for hotels. But the idea is that there's this whole long list of building features that impact energy use. And only a subset of those are actually features of the building design. So you can design a really efficient building to improve energy use, and it addresses all the things in yellow, but it doesn't have anything to do with any of the gray features, which also impact energy use to lesser, to a greater or lesser degree. So the point is that building energy use of any building is driven in large part by design, absolutely, but also by the way the building is operated and maintained, and by the way the occupants in the space behave. And it's not just about building physical features or design, although that has a lot to do with setting the capabilities of the building. The way the occupants behave and the way the building is maintained and operated has huge impact on building energy use as well as design. And if you think about that graph that Clark showed with the inaccuracy of energy models and the fact that buildings use more or less than predicted, I believe that that has mostly to do with operation and occupancy variables. They're not models, because you always model just one point in time for how the occupants can behave and how the systems can be maintained. But the reality is there's a wide variation that has nothing to do with design. So my firm recently did a study of this, which, there we go, that we call the sensitivity analysis, where we looked at different variables in building characteristics to see what was driving energy use. And again, this is an office example. We haven't done this study for hospitality, but the results will be similar. But the point is, if you look, what you're seeing here is a graph of the impact of different building features. So on the left side in the green square are design features, things like glazing area, glazing performance, insulation levels, lighting, LPD, and lighting control, and HVAC system sizing and efficiency, et cetera. All that stuff's in the green. And the size of the bar represents the range of energy outcomes that you can achieve with a typical design response. So, for example, on the insulation graph, which is the fourth bar, if we go with code, which is the zero line where the bar changes in color, that's, you know, you just built the building to code insulation, you get that performance. If you use an old code or you have an existing building, the energy use is higher, and that's the yellow side of this bar. And if you use the most aggressive insulation strategy that's in ASHRAE 189, for example, which is a proposed code that's not adopted, and you increase the efficiency, you get down in the green, you get about 10%, 15% reduction in energy use just from that feature. So the point is that the big bars are the real opportunity in building performance. And so you look at over to the right in the red and blue squares, these are things that have nothing to do with design. This is how the building is operated, how the occupants behave. So if you look in the blue square, for example, there's some pretty big bars here having to do with flood loads, whether people turn their computers off at night, what the set points are, whether they maintain a setback at night and, you know, shut the building down at night or fail to. Those are huge impacts on building energy use that have nothing to do with building design. And so what you realize is that operation strategies and tenant interaction, occupant interaction, are huge opportunities for savings in existing buildings. So in the hospitality industry, you've all sort of probably heard of these, or probably many of you use, these key card activators where the lights don't come on and the HVAC system in an individual guest room doesn't come on unless the key is placed in this box when you walk into your room, which is a great way to sort of enforce energy savings behavior by the tenant, by the occupants, or by your guests. But the other side of that is that your staff is also driving this to a great degree, and I'll tell you personally, you know, I personally can't tell you how many times I've set my, in my, you know, typical geeky energy consultant way, set down my thermostat when I leave my hotel room and come back to find that the maids have turned it back to their standard setting, which is, you know, straight ahead. And I think there's a huge opportunity not just for trying to interface with the guests about performance, but also with the staff that are in the building, as well as the operations, of course, which is a whole other aspect of hotel energy use, which is your maintenance and operation personnel. And you can make a huge difference in energy performance with good training and good behavior by good operations practices. So how do you know if you're doing this? And this is the key to the whole idea with what Clark was talking about, transparency, and what I call disclosure. So if you think about, for example, you get into a nice car, this happens to be an Audi dashboard, and just looking at the dashboard, pretty much anyone who's got a driver's license will look at this and be able to count up 17 pieces of real-time information that are immediately available to you in order to manage the way your car is operating. In this case, one of the displays is miles per gallon, and it's a well-known, in fact, it's called the Prius effect. In Prius vehicles, they actually have real-time miles per gallon display that's very much highlighted, and people tend to drive to improve their mileage, and so they actually, because of the feedback, they act to reduce energy use in their vehicle. This is, documented over and over again. But the point here is that there's a bunch of information about performance that's available to you. In a typical building, it's very, very different. There's almost nothing available to occupants about improving their behavior in a way to reduce energy use. And there's this huge opportunity to reduce building energy use by interacting more effectively with operations, occupant, tenant, whatever you call it. And also, I think, with guests, perhaps. And if you look at some of the data from just providing information to occupants about how much energy their building is using, you see huge savings, huge changes in behavior from having information available that can make decisions based on that reduced building energy skills compared to having no idea how they're impacting behavior. So that's sort of the interaction with the tenants. If you think about on a broader scale, how do we compare buildings? I ask all the time when I'm talking to people, how many people know the gas mileage of your car? And almost everyone raises their hand. How many people know how much energy your building uses in a year? Almost nobody. Right? It's like a totally new area of thinking about how our buildings are performing. Again, using the car analogy, this is the data that you can get about any car you're thinking about buying. It's this whole list of characteristics that you can use to make decisions about what's important to you about the car in terms of operational efficiency, standardized performance data, features, technical characteristics. You never get this stuff when you're looking at buildings. Nothing like this. And we're starting to see changes in that. This is a data that the USGBC works with my firm, NBI, to provide to buildings that will share energy use data. And it allows you to sort of diagnose your performance and compare yourself to other buildings in your class. And Clark showed a graph like this as well. And, of course, you've probably heard of building dashboards, which are kind of getting at the same thing, where we're starting to be able to compare different buildings to each other to understand our buildings in real time. And, this is sort of a new field. It's mostly designed as started as an educational piece, but now it's moving into a tool to guide operations and tenant behavior, and you're going to see more and more of that. So the point is that moving forward from a policy and market standpoint, we're going to see more and more focus on sharing data about energy use. So I'm going to go back to this slide where I showed you the subset of features of this building that are actually driven by design, and take it one step further. In this case, the red highlighted words, these are the things that are actually regulated by energy codes. So energy codes even are a smaller subset of building energy use than just design, which is a subset of total building energy use because of occupant and operation. So what you realize is that we are trying to get very aggressive performance out of a very small subset of building features. And so if you look at the goals that have been set for building performance, which is this red line going down to net zero by 2030, is mandated in California and is a guideline in other places. And then you look at the blue line, which is the stringency of national codes. You see that the national codes are trying to follow this line down because this is the policy goal that has been set. And the last round of codes was a pretty substantial increase in efficiency, 19%. And so we're going to have to work harder and harder to get efficiency out of our buildings. But at the same time, since codes only regulate a very small percentage of total building energy use, we're going to be looking more and more at interacting with building operation and to get the kind of performance we're looking for. So Clark showed a slide with that showed which cities have adopted requirements for disclosure. This is the same slide with a few more categories where states that are looking at this or have proposed it and not adopted it yet or have it on the docket or whatever. And, it, you know, it's actually spreading quite rapidly, the concept that we're going to be sharing information about building performance more widely. And, you know, this is a graphic that somebody put together to sort of represent what this might look like, where any given building has a rating on it that anyone can see and see which building is efficient and which is not. And, of course, this would never play out this way with the bold graphics on the building. And in the U.S., most of these disclosure requirements are semi-private, meant to be between a potential buyer and the seller. And, of course, you know, the buyer can compare, but they have to be a real buyer. It's not just Joe on the street. But in Australia, actually, they have adopted a protocol where this label is, in fact, in the lobby of the building. And you can, Joe Public can walk into the building and see how the building is performing and walk to the building across the street and see if it's doing better. So this is becoming more common. And interestingly, 2 weeks ago, McDonald's announced that it was going to put calorie information right on its menu. And the idea is that, you know, putting calorie information on the menu does not make the food less fattening. What it does is it allows the user to decide which item to order off the menu and hopefully make better decisions about their health by ordering things with lower calories. But, of course, immediately you get this comparison in the Wall Street Journal where they're actually comparing different brands and different foods and looking across to decide, you know, how does McDonald's compare to Burger King or Taco Bell or whatever. And this is not necessarily the intent of McDonald's putting their calorie information on the menu, but the outcome is immediately a comparison across the sector. And if you think about how this might play out in buildings, you can realize that all of a sudden there's going to be a lot more data for people to consider in making decisions about hotel stays or what have you. And, you know, this is another example. This is, I think, from Google Buildings, where you can look at building energy use for all the buildings that are participating and hover over it and see which building it is. And the information is becoming more and more available, and this is going to drive policy and codes and behavior in the market because of the perceived market benefit of being a more efficient building. So disclosure policies are a big deal. They're going to force attention on performance outcome. They're going to encourage effective building operations. Everyone who's in cities with disclosure ordinances is starting to pay attention to what the implications are. It's going to improve the accuracy of modeling because design teams will need to better predict and understand how buildings are really going to perform. They're not going to be able to just say, this is a better building, but not necessarily be right about total energy use. And I think there's going to be a much bigger recognition of occupant role in building performance in the hospitality industry. That's not just your guests, but also your staff. And it's really going to change the way buildings perform in the future, I think. And with that, I will leave it to Tom.
Great. Thank you, Mark. What I'm going to do next is zoom down in levels from the building energy performance level that we've been talking about down to the room health performance level. We, in the hospitality industry, we invest a lot in the user experience and making the room kind of place that someone's going to want to stay, sort of feel comfortable in, feel at ease, that promotes well-being. Unfortunately, we're discovering as we look deeper into what's going on in the materials that we're using in our building construction, that a large number of materials we use are emitting various materials that are not good for your health. We've been looking for quite a while at volatile organic compounds as our first metric here for meaning those chemicals that off-gas. You may think of this as that new carpet smell, as the fresh paint smell. And those chemicals not only smell, but can lead to any number of bad health outcomes ranging from asthma to cancer. But before you start thinking about outfitting your rooms with inhalers and gas masks and MRIs, let me reassure you that we've got a whole set of of metrics, some that have been around for quite a while, others that are emerging just this year that you can engage with to improve the health experience of your rooms. The oldest is maybe the VOC content, the volatiles that are netted into a wet applied product like paint or another coating. We've had labels for some time, like the Green Seal label, and labeling, like the zero VOC label, advertising manufacturers' efforts to drive that content of volatiles down to zero and make these paints and adhesives and caulks and high performance coatings safer for both external health. This is originally something we started looking at to address smog, but increasingly our understanding its impact on health to the person in the interior as well. But it turns out that it's not only paints and other wet applied things that have VOC problems, as that new carpet smell implies. Solid materials like your flooring, your wall covering, your ceiling tiles, your furniture, all can have VOC problems as well. We've been addressing this in the Green Building Movement for a while also with the approach of putting a sample of that product into a test lab, measuring the rate at which the volatiles emit off of it, running that through a model to predict what the concentration will be in a room, and then comparing that against various authoritative governmental charts of safe levels of those volatiles. The result of that is a set of labels that some of you who've been working in green building for a while will recognize that apply to different product types to certify their matching these or staying below these levels of concern for these volatiles. And the USCBC and its lead program has been recognizing products that meet those and providing credit for using those in interiors for some time now. This isn't, however, the end of the story. It turns out there are another set of chemicals that aren't captured by these programs. The EPA published a list of chemicals of concern several years ago based on looking at biomonitoring studies, that is looking at blood samples from people all over the country and seeing what kind of chemicals that had toxic concerns are also showing up in people's bloodstreams and been identified by the EPA as chemicals they think are particularly concerning due to the level of exposure and to the kind of health problems that they can cause. Turns out that we use quite a few of these chemicals in the building material industry, including quite widely in the materials with which we finish our rooms. So what do we do about that? Let's look at a particular one, first of all, to understand what's going on here. So it's in the material. Is it actually getting, you know, is that actually what's causing the exposure to the person? Well, if we start looking at dust samples from vacuum cleaners across the country, and we've been finding each of the materials on the EPA list of concern ubiquitously in these samples. The stuff is leaving the building products and making it into the dust, which then makes it into people. Phthalates are just an example of that. They're a plasticizer that's used to make vinyl flooring, vinyl wall covering, and other flexible PVC or vinyl products. They'll be able to move since vinyl is inherently rigid without it. But they're not well bound into the material and tend to dust out. They can cause reproductive toxicity. Messing with what's going on is that the child is developing in the womb. It can be asthma triggers the child later on and lead to obesity as you get older. And as I mentioned, the phthalates are not VOCs, as is the case with all of the other chemicals on the EPA list of concern that I showed earlier, which means that these labels that are measuring the volatiles, measuring what off gases, aren't capturing these things that are leaving the materials by other pathways and getting into our bodies yet. It's only giving us one piece of the story. What do we do about that? The response has been rather chaotic. Different rating systems like LEED and the Living Building Challenge and Green Guide for Healthcare and LEED for Healthcare and different firms have all developed different red lists of chemicals to avoid depending on different criteria to determine priorities. This has led to a nightmare for manufacturers and designers alike trying to determine where to go. Manufacturers aren't making it very easy yet to address it, even once you decide on a red list with technical data sheets and MSDSs, often that look like this, hiding more information than they're disclosing. Enter into this the Health Product Declaration. This is an open format standard for manufacturers to communicate product content and health hazard. It's been designed by and for a large group of design professionals and building owners that got together last year to tackle this problem of transparency in building materials and develop a system for a consistent communication of information about content and hazard. It's intended to address the whole chain of communication from the manufacturers to the various elements of the design and construction process, and ultimately to the owner. Google's been a big leverage point in here, making a major commitment to using this disclosure and encouraging manufacturers to engage. You can too. The Health Product Declaration, still under development right now, identifies exactly how to communicate what's in a product, how to identify its content, and how to identify the health hazards that authoritative bodies have listed for it. It also summarizes how well a manufacturer is disclosing their information at this stage and how deep they're driving, and provides a structure for identifying those certifications and what they do and do not cover within the Health Product Declaration. We've run a pilot now with the first draft of this declaration. We were looking for about a dozen manufacturers. 30 wanted to get in on the process. A lot of manufacturers, many manufacturers have been hesitant about disclosing. Others are seeing that this is the wave and may actually be an important opportunity for them to differentiate themselves from other manufacturers. So we ended up with 30 participating in a pilot to test out our initial version of this declaration. 29 of the 30 actually completed a declaration for one or more of their products. And then we're just finishing up a review cycle with 50 representatives from different design and ownership firms who reviewed the HPDs that were produced by the manufacturers and gave us a lot of really good feedback. We're finishing our revise now and aiming to release this for public use this fall, definitely before our Best Buy by Green Build in November. So all well and good. You get a lot of information about what's in products and various hazards that have been identified in them. What do you do with that? How do you weigh the different warnings and concerns and contents that you get? We've been addressing that with something called the Pharos Project. Healthy Building Network has been working on for several years, where we've taken those different certification programs for VOC emissions and scored them, identifying what their strengths and weaknesses are to give them relative scoring, and then done the same with chemicals and the hazard warnings that various government bodies have assigned to them, using something called the Green Screen for Safer Chemicals, which is a benchmarking system that has been developed to rate different types of health hazards along a spectrum of concern. We've rated the hazards identified by 26 different authoritative governmental bodies on over 20,000 chemicals, and we use that to create a score for the toxicity of the content of materials in building products. You can drill down into an individual product, find out why it scores the way it does on several measures, and into a chemical to find out what the authoritative bodies have said about its potential cancer, endocrine disruption, asthmogenic properties, et cetera. Now, this is all providing a lot of opportunities to look at materials and try to not just avoid bad chemicals, but avoid making regrettable substitutions as well, which I mean when you avoid a chemical because of a particular red list, you want to look carefully at the alternatives and find out what they've got in them and not just pick a product because it doesn't have formaldehyde in it, for example, but make sure that the alternative that's being used instead of formaldehyde doesn't have concerns of its own that are even worse. Right, to do this, we've got to get information from the manufacturers. Disclosure is key, and many of them still consider that information top secret. However, between a combination of the health product declaration encouraging more manufacturers to come forward and disclose what's in their products and a wide range of different research tools that we use to look at patents and industry information and disclosures in other countries, we've found we've been able to find a surprisingly large amount of information about what's inside products, which has convinced more and more manufacturers to come forward and clear their names. The disclosure era is here. We are seeing a real tipping point right now in the interest in manufacturers in talking about engaging in this conversation between users and manufacturers. So we're at a point where we can change this story and clean up that room, get rid of the emissions of volatiles, get rid of the dust off of non-volatiles and semi-volatiles that may be affecting your customers. And so you raised the question, though, of when do you engage and how do you engage? Many design firms and owners and manufacturers have for a long time avoided really addressing these issues. It seemed complicated, and it seemed better that the less you know, the better. Looking deep into this only causes trouble. But there's a change afoot in the public view of toxicity in materials, and one only has to look at what happened with sippy cups and sports water bottles recently to realize that the landscape can change really rapidly for an industry when concerns about chemicals and toxicity spread publicly. And the best mode is to stay ahead of it and understand what you're working with before it hits the headlines. So you can do it, take a positive approach on this. Instead of being caught by a bisphenol A type of disaster that's happened to the sippy cups, you can build your reputation for healthy lodging, building on the metrics that we have available in our building into the system with the VOC certifications, demanding transparency with the health product declaration, and screening for toxic content with tools like we're providing with Pharos to actually rate those materials. And with that, I will conclude my formal part, and we can go to our wrap-up and then take your questions. So take it away, Clark.
Thanks, Tom. That was great. I'm always amazed to hear about all the stuff that's inside our systems that is unregulated that's hurting us every time I hear you speak.
So, it's rather mind-blowing. Most people assume that that EPA has this all regulated and down pat, and they would have heard about it if it was a problem. But the truth is that EPA hasn't even really successfully been able to regulate asbestos, much less the chemicals we're talking about now.
Right. So in the wrap-up, I'm just going to touch on a little bit of what is happening in the industry from my perspective, both moving in the Green Building Council world, but also doing our work here at Sarah Architects. But there are a number of things that are happening in these transparency-focused discussions. One is a new district that's being created in Seattle called the 2030 District. And this is a business district that where the businesses in the area, and you can see, those of you who know Seattle can see that it's a fairly sizable area, including downtown, where the businesses are banding together and agreeing to set district-wide goals around energy performance. They actually already have a website up. You can go to it, and they're reporting their current energy use and their current progress against energy use reductions, water use reductions, and changes in transportation mode split.
Clark, at the risk of interrupting, I will tell you that there are now 5 other cities who have mimicked that.
And growing every month at this point. It's interesting that this was built on the idea around, both Mark and I talked about the 2030 challenge and its work in trying to set a pathway towards zero energy use in the built environment by 2030. This is a very innovative response to that, because this is actual businesses doing work in buildings in Seattle that they've decided this is going to give them a competitive advantage by working together. So it's just one interesting example around that. I think another thing, especially after seeing both Mark's and Tom's presentation, there is one of the themes that's heading around transparency is there's a growing movement in America around the public right to know. And all of these things trend towards that. The sippy cup revolution that came about was tied directly to the public's right to know about what was in those products. So one of the things that Mark touched on around energy had to do with occupant energy use and building operations. And one of the interesting pieces is that even once we've identified that as a big issue, we really don't have a lot of tools available to us yet to start to shift the way people use energy in buildings or the way building operators help people do that. So there's a growing movement around occupant engagement, and the whole notion is that we need to get information to people for them to make different decisions. And there's a whole series of work around that. This is a list of energy efficiency measures that Sarah was working on with GBD Architects on the Oregon Sustainability Center, which is a living building high-rise project in Portland. And there are many, many energy use reduction strategies, as you can imagine, but occupant engagement actually is key. One of the interesting things we demonstrated to the tenants here, and we did have an active tenant group in this process, is that by using standard high-performance, ultra-low-energy design practices, we can get that building to perform 60 to 65% better than code. And this is becoming fairly standard in the industry around LEED Platinum or LEED Platinum Plus buildings, that without talking to the occupants or engaging them through automation and best practices approaches, we can get to this, but that's actually not enough to get a high rise to net zero. So we needed to create a different dialogue. We came up with energy saving strategies that are directly tied to tenant usage of the buildings. We then calibrated those instead of using kilowatt hours saved, which we found is pretty abstract for people. We correlated the savings into dollars you would have to spend on additional solar panels in order to get your building to net zero. We tried to drive it back to capital cost or first cost, and that seemed to work. It really did raise the discussion, but I'm actually going to go back one slide. One of the key pieces in this is that when you squeeze a building down to 60 to 65% better than code, the plug loads become roughly 50% or better of the total energy use. That really got the tenants' attention, and I think for operators of hotels, the whole notion that a super efficient hotel then is more than half the energy use is being driven by the occupants and the operation. So what we set out, and we worked with the tenants on these tenant-saving strategies, we were able to carve out another 12% of savings by engaging the occupants. And that does get that building to net zero, at least in the model. So next is, I went too fast. But what are the devices that are coming out to help us do that? There's Precious View right now. This is a device being devised by Intel for use in people's homes around this, but there are a variety of other dashboard devices. It's interesting in the engagement realm that the dashboard concept Mark showed you has actually already gotten a lot of traction in the building operations world. It's no surprise because building operators were already used to looking at data in the forms of graphs and dials. So we're getting more and more sophisticated responses there, but we don't have a lot of choices about how to engage the public yet. At this point, this is a thought experiment that came out of our work on the Oregon Sustainability Center based on feedback mechanisms for people. But again, what does transparency energy use for a building look like at many scales? Because for this net zero high rise, we'd like people going by on the street or even cars driving by to be able to see how the building's doing against its goals. And that would be at the building facade scale. But as people enter the building, even if they're transient visitors, we would expect them to be interested to know a lot more about how that building's working. And then as people move to their offices, they would need to know how their office is doing against energy use. In fact, I saw one of the questions come through about how is energy use being divided up in multi-tenant buildings. We're going to need to figure that out. Any multi-tenant building that's going for net zero is actually going to be assigning an energy budget per capita for every tenant in the building. Think about all the implications around leases and contracts associated with that kind of a setup. And then finally, at the individual level, we know that we're going to have great access to people through these incredibly smart devices we all have now. But what does that access look like, and what sort of information do we need to give people to make it engaging? There is a work happening here, but again, I think it's very nascent. It's very early. There's huge industry opportunities to engage here, and I actually think in the hospitality world, there are huge opportunities. The notion of someone coming into a hotel with their PDA or their smartphone and basically connecting to their hotel stay and having the hotel start to deliver them interesting, meaningful information, everything about their place, the city they're visiting and the hotel they're in, to the way their room is working and all the features that that particular hotel has done to improve the health of their space or the energy use of it. So Mark talked about codes. I just want to make sure all the attendees to this webinar leave the webinar realizing that we are moving towards more transparent disclosure mechanisms around energy use in building, and eventually the codes will catch up to that as well, and the building codes or outcome-based codes will actually be developed so that the code-compliant building won't be fully code-compliant until it proves its actual energy use. That's definitely something for all of us to think about as we leave this webinar. So then, to wrap up a little on green materials in terms of what's happening in the industry, before I talk about this slide, I do want to touch back on something Tom talked about with Google and the leadership Google's showing in the area of transparency around toxicity of materials. Any of you who have seen Google present at Green Build or the Living Future Conference in the last 2 years has been seeing them talk about the evolution in their thinking around the Red List. And it's been very interesting. 2 years ago, they stated that all their North American projects would be built in accordance with the Living Building Challenge Red List. It was a huge step in the whole movement for them to do that. But as they did that, they found it was very, very difficult to get accurate information. And even well-intentioned manufacturers who wanted to work with them didn't know what was in their stuff or didn't know how to communicate that back to Google. So Google has shifted their thinking. And in shifting their thinking, they're now rewarding transparency first, and then they will have additional rewards around product procurement associated with toxic reduction. But first and foremost, they're saying, if you're willing to play with us and work with us to be transparent about what is in your product, we will be more favorable about procuring your product. And then when we have that information, we can then set out on a toxics avoidance strategy. But that is a big shift in thinking, has huge implications on the industry. So now I'm going to just deconstruct a product for you as a sample for how this thinking goes. This is the deconstruction of a solar panel, again using the Living Building Challenge Red List as a target. And if you look, you can see that there are lots and lots of complex pieces in a solar panel that actually already contain a lot of red listed compounds. And to date, the Living Building Challenge has actually had to acknowledge that the market isn't ready. There are many, many products that just simply aren't ready for this. I saw an earlier question go through the chat line about fire codes and toxics. And what's interesting, an example of this is currently almost all the electrical wiring in America is sheathed in PVC or polyvinyl chloride. And there's one company, to our knowledge, that makes electrical cabling that's not sheathed. It's actually sheathed in polyolefin. And the reason for that is that the military was using, they were finding out that fires that were happening inside submarines and tanks were having a very bad effect on the people inside because people were dying from smoke inhalation or getting very, very injured from the smoke inhalation long before the fire became dangerous. So they had to create a different type of electrical wiring, sheathing. I think hotel rooms are another great example. The number of compounds in that hotel room that have been developed, including the fire retardants, are potentially hazardous to our health, and we need to figure out what we're going to do about that. Here's just a couple other examples around that. We're starting to have green alternatives, and with the tools that Tom outlined, we're going to have a lot more success at driving the market. What's interesting to me about the hospitality industry is the high quantity of products that you purchase, especially for the interiors of your spaces, is a huge opportunity for the hospitality industry to work together to actually move the market and move it quickly, similarly to what Google's trying to do in their transparency project. Tom already showed you some complex information flows. This is a diagram we did of the decision tree around product procurement for a building. It is not easy, and it's going to take a lot of work. The reality is we're going, in order to move the market, we're going to need to develop relationships. We don't want this to all happen by regulation. And if there's one of the themes of our talk today is, and the reason we hope you're attending this webinar is to try and get ahead of these things. There are smart things we can do to make better buildings that are healthier and more energy efficient without waiting for regulation to drive us to do it. And again, the HPD that Tom talked about, which will be unveiled formally at Green Build, is going to be a huge tool in that, but it's just one tool, as is Pharos. A lot of this is going to drive innovation in the marketplace. I'm hoping there are product manufacturers on this webinar. Huge opportunity here to get ahead of the industry and work with the whole movement to improve this. There is one other type of transparency I want to talk about. This is a hotel that we did in Portland. And this is a study that was actually done by Gary Gola, who introduced all of us here at the beginning today. And it's transparency in finance. I think owners who are on this webinar could demand much more of your design teams to work with you on coming up with clear understandings around the financial performance of your projects. I don't think that's a very transparent thing right now. Architects are not having good dialogues with their clients. It's a two-way street, but I think having the owner reach out to the design teams and encourage them to understand better what your financial interests are would really help the architects provide you better products. And that's a transparency piece as well. So with that, that is the formal end of our talk. I believe questions have been coming in, and I think Gary's been sorting through them. But Gary, before you hand me the first question, I do want to ask a question of Mark, which is, Mark, you just did that sensitivity study for office space. I'm guessing that you might also be interested in doing a similar study for the hospitality industry if you could find partners in that. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We are expanding our work in that into some other sectors. But hospitality is not one that's currently on our list of immediate because, you know, my firm is not particularly well connected with the hospitality industry, but I'd be happy to work with any of you guys to explore that more fully. And it certainly gets at helping you prioritize responses to improving performance.
Great. Okay, Gary, how about the first question?
Okay. The first question asked, there's been surveys of drivers some years ago that indicated that gas would have to cost over $4.50 per gallon before drivers would change their habits and start to consider more efficient cars. Is there an equivalent in research for hotels? Where is the pain threshold for hotel owners and operators?
Well, this is Mark, and I will say that that data is much more variable in the building sector because of all the different ways that projects are financed, whether they're leased or built to suit or owned by, you know, tenant-owned or whatever. But what you definitely see is utility prices over the long term have gone up, 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 with the most recent exception of natural gas, which has dropped pretty substantially. And that's, but there's no right answer for how much it hurts to have energy prices. You know, I already showed you on a graph, you know, data from the EPA that that's 6% of hotel operating costs and the fastest growing cost. But, you know, when does it cross a threshold? It's different for every project.
Yeah, and I would say, based on our experience working in hospitality, the pain threshold for the hospitality market has everything to do with the guests and the guest experience and making sure that they're coming to that hotel in the at the pace and in the way, at the stay rate that is expected. And what's interesting is that I think we have a growing, there'll be growing education in the guests about what they're looking for, and that'll be both around green hotels that are doing everything from energy efficiency work and water efficiency work to providing a healthier stay. And I think hotels that can get ahead of that and actually get that built into their buildings and then messaged back to their guests are going to have a huge edge on the other hotels, especially when all this information becomes publicly available and transparent.
Our next question has to do with energy management systems. Is it better for the guest to know about the energy management system and be involved or use a system that is invisible to the guest?
This gets back to the feedback question, and I guess I would differentiate between energy management systems and information provided to the guest. The energy management system is typically a building operator system. They're very complicated, and Clark said some dashboards with the idea that building operators are using those more and more, and that's true, but there's so much data. I heard a great quote once that the typical building automation system today generates as much data every 20 minutes as Shakespeare's collected works. And there's no way you're going to provide any kind of information at that level to tenants. What the tenants need to know is, how can I help? What is the implication of my behavior, and how can I help? And that's where you see some of these really simple graphics, you know, even just color-coded lights. You know, light, red light, you're using a lot more energy than your neighbors. Green light, you're using a lot less energy than your neighbors. That, you know, you have to really target the message to both what they can interface with and what they're willing to absorb. So the casual guest moving through the hotel, very, very simple data is appropriate. For the building operator, you know, they can be much more sophisticated as long as you give them a way to sort through all the data.
Yeah, and I think we want that information to the guests to be simple, but we also want it to be interesting. And as you alluded to, Mark, one of the things that's proving to be interesting for people is how they do compared to someone. It could be other people in their hotel. It could be a variety of other things, but people seem to remain more interested when they're seeing their performance compared to someone else. Next.
To dig down into this question a little bit more, in guest rooms, we often see either an occupancy sensor that controls the thermostat or a key card to control the thermostat. What are your thoughts of which system provides greater efficiency, or is there a balance between that and maybe getting a guest to actually participate, use a key card, and think about efficiency? Because I have a feeling that the electronic, the sensor systems may actually perform better than the key cards.
Well, and those can be mixed. I mean, you can have a key card that activates the room, and then occupancy sensor can still turn off lights. But I would say, you know, the experience people have with occupancy sensors is it can be mixed depending on what they're doing. You know, someone who sits still for a long time on the bed doesn't necessarily want the light to go off, da-da-da. And so I would say that the key card, you know, for one thing, you're right, there's an educational component of them interacting. But for another, you don't want to be annoyed by the controls. It's no annoyance to put your card in an activator. And that's, if you think about the savings, the first step is the big step, and everything you do after that is probably a smaller step. So having a key that activates the room system saves a whole bunch of energy. Adding occupancy sensors on top of that might save a little bit more, but not as much as the first step, if that makes sense. But I think, you know, it depends on the situation. You don't want key cards in offices, but in guest rooms, that's a really good technology. And you can decide what's controlled by it.
Hey, Gary, how about a question around materials?
Is there such a thing as a definitive list of VOCs, toxins, et cetera?
Well, there a definitive list would be pretty long, because there are plenty of red lists that are very, you know, sharply tuned short lists of pretty chemicals to start from. But if we look at the number of chemicals that have been identified as carcinogens or mutagens or reproductive toxicants or asthmogens, whatever, and we want to identify them and the relative level of hazard and work our way to inherently safer materials, then it kind of gets beyond where you can just publish a short list and go with that, and that's really where it gets into the need to use tools that can sort through those lists, where you plug in an ingredient and get an answer from a tool that's harvesting all of the different lists. That's why we developed the chemical library and the Pharos tool that tracks those lists, keeps up to date. You know, one of the problems being that the science is evolving, and so the authoritative governmental lists are being updated regularly. So any effort to just make a static list of chemicals is bound to become out of date fairly soon. It's a dynamic. You know, it's a dynamic situation. But the good news, you know, that's kind of the depressing news. The good news is that there are increasing number of tools available that automate this whole process, that allow you to put the contents of a product in and get a profile of it out when you're trying to select from the design specifier side. And likewise for the manufacturer, as they're trying to design to inherently safer chemicals. Because the last thing you want to do is just go after a, if you can avoid it, is go after a short list of chemicals only, and then have the alternative that you selected be the one that ends up at the top of the priority list the next year. So we're kind of looking for indicators not only for what's at the top of the heap right now, but where the early indicators of harm are emerging in the science, so we can alert designers and alert the industrial designers on how to design those out entirely. It's where the green screen comes into play, because it's actually benchmarks, not just identifying worst in class chemicals, but benchmarks the chemical safety all the way to all the way up to a green level of inherently quite safe. And that's what we're really trying to move manufacturers toward, is to really look beyond the headlines and the bisphenol A's that are attracting attention right now, and really think about designing with green chemistry into inherently safe materials that won't end up in tomorrow's headlines.
So that's a good segue to something I neglected to mention during my presentation, but I wanted to point out. Both Mark and I had showed slides about policy changes that are happening across the country around energy use reporting, but I also wanted to tell everyone it's very late-breaking news. Just last week, there have been policies passed around transparency and product procurement in Oregon. And so at the state level, the governor has issued an executive order around fostering environmentally friendly purchasing and product design, and that's based largely on the notion of transparency. And then the city of Portland and Multnomah County, which is the county that the city is in, have gone into a joint product purchasing policy that is focusing again on the notion of transparency first and then in order to achieve toxics avoidance over time. So I think that's just the beginning, that there are policies already being issued around product procurement that will favor transparency.
Right, and Clark, I think we're going to see the same thing in LEED with with the way the concerns credits are developing, and in LEED, I think we're likely to see a credit that rewards both transparency and avoidance as a stepwise, the same way you described that Google is working towards, and that the Portland is.
Okay, Gary.
What is the opinion of the panelists on USDA's certified bio-based product program? Will this help small farmers and suppliers achieve some type of recognition for agri-based materials?
It certainly does encourage consideration of bio-based materials and provide rewards for them. It's important to understand, though, that the USDA bio-preferred program only looks at whether a product has plant-based materials in it or not, and just within at a threshold that they judge based on sort of market availability right now. It does not address the sustainability of that agricultural or forestry sourcing the material. In other words, it's not giving preference to organic, other low pesticide or low soil loss approaches to making bio-based materials. So it's a pretty narrow criteria right now that unfortunately misses a lot of the potential environmental implications that would be involved if we did shift in a large way from petroleum-based to bio-based materials. So approach with caution and apply other factors as well when you look at bio-based materials.
Yeah, I can actually punctuate that. There's a blown insulation that's meant to substitute for blown isonine, which is a petroleum-based blown insulation. It's very efficient. It's very effective at what it does, but it is petroleum-based. And there came out a bio-based solution. In fact, I think an early version of it was even called bio-based insulation.
Right.
And when you dig into it, we found out that it was only 40% vegetable or bio-based products, and the rest still had to be petroleum. And they neglected to tell us that until we dug into it.
And, in fact, many of those are in the single digits, less than 10% bio-based. Even though they label as bio-based, which is another reason for transparency, so we can get beyond the labels and understand what we're really seeing.
Yeah. How about another energy question, Gary?
Is there an app or software program on the market that lists energy consumption, city highlights, consumption comparisons?
There are a bunch of things going on in the energy world for apps and things like that. There's a lot of companies that have come out with diagnostics. There's a lot of control companies coming out with dashboards and tools. It's a very, very busy space right now. A couple I might steer you towards are Noesis, I think it's called Noesis, which is designed to give feedback at a relatively low price, and Honest Buildings, which is trying to gather comparison data for buildings and work towards disclosure. My firm has a tool called FirstView that we use for diagnostic as well. And there's a bunch of tools coming out in that space. So, yes, there's many, 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 many.
Yeah, I would actually punctuate the Honest Building ones. I can't remember the website, Mark. I think it may be honestbuildings.org. But if you Google it, you will get there. What's interesting about Honest Buildings is that it's effectively social media for buildings. And I think green hospitality locations that wanted to promote themselves would find it to be an easy-to-use place to go today to start talking about the things you're doing. But it is in a kind of a social media or a Facebook for buildings format.
There's a follow-up question to that. Is there anything specific for hospitality guests at this point?
No, not that I know of.
There's a couple of firms that are focused on hospitality energy performance that I came across in the last couple of days even. I think they're more service providers. You know, they will help you manage your energy use or invest in improvements as opposed to comparison documentation. So I'm not aware of a disclosure comparison tool, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Now, my sense is it's a space ripe for entrepreneurs to step into and really accentuate the guest experience from the minute they check in.
Another question on performance and reporting. How does the move towards performance reporting and performance-based code affect design firm liability and product manufacturer liability?
That is a really good question that has not been answered, and I noticed there's a lot of lawyers circling this issue, and in fact, our lead study a couple of years ago led to a lawsuit against the USGBC, which was dismissed. What, I guess, to summarize this briefly, if there's more attention on actual building outcome, then that becomes part of the discussion, and the design team needs to be aware that that information will be part of the discussion. And so what in the past has happened is that the design team is focused on the things within their control, and they've just sort of set values. So for example, in the energy model, this is where the data comes from. They set values for hours of use, set points, how well the efficient equipment will run, how the occupants will behave, how much they will plug in, whether they will turn it off. Those are all just assumed. And you do the energy model to see, is it better to use better windows or more insulation or a different system? And you never really look at the occupant behavior and operation side of it. And then that gets passed to the owner or what have you, and you know, a year later they look back and they see that their building's not really using the same amount of energy as predicted by the model. And they think it's the design team's fault because they told them that's what was going to happen. And what's going to happen is a couple things. First of all, there's going to be a lot better communication between the design team and the owner operations team that what we're predicting is based on you behaving this way, and if you behave differently, it's going to change the answer. And it may be that the analysis will include a range of outcome for how the owner uses the building, as well as a range of outcome for the different design features, and I think that'll be really important. The other thing is that there's, you know, no self-respecting design team will fail to follow up and see whether they were getting it right in the first place and try to understand why, because they don't want to be on the hook later for the owner coming back and saying, why is my building doing what you said? You know, they have to be able to decide whether it was because something was built differently or something was not included or something they did was not as assumed or whether the owner's not operating the building the way they anticipated. So maybe that's a long-winded answer. But.
Tom, what are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, I'll bring you back on that. On the material health issue, I think that with the growing public awareness of the connections between materials and health, there is a looming legal challenge for the industry if they do not address these issues. I think that particularly tackling the transparency issue aggressively and using it throughout the chain, so in other words, evening out the information of who knows what about the potential hazards involved with materials, can do a lot to protect a design firm, for example, from being on the hook when someone further down the chain says, you should have told us that the materials you were specifying were toxic, or you should have known. But while using a tool like the health product declaration is not only a good tool for helping with smart selection, but also for evening out the distribution of knowledge, so that those in the middle of the chain who are trying to make the best judgments on this can communicate down what the basis of it and make sure that owners share in that responsibility. Similarly to what Mark just described with energy.
Yeah, this is Clark, and I'm going to add to this. As an architect, where our firm has, in the last couple of years, gotten to work on two different outcome-based projects, I would say. Remember that we're seeing outcome-based codes come to us in years in the future, but we've already had the GSA hire us to do a building that has to achieve an ENERGY STAR score of 97. So we've actually got an outcome-based energy metric. And then we've also been working on the Oregon Sustainability Center, which has outcome-based metrics on energy, water, toxics, waste. And what's interesting in that discussion with the client is not only is the design team's interest piqued because we're going to be working on the project and accountable well into occupancy, but it has also changed the dialogue with the clients because the clients have shared responsibility in how the building is operated, how the occupants inside use the building, and they have the owners have quite a bit of responsibility in the final material selection. So it's really interesting to see us moving into a world of much richer discussions and shared responsibility. I think the IPD, or Integrated Project Delivery Model, which right now is only very limited in its use in the industry, may grow as the idea of a cooperative delivery method shows more and more benefit.
I have one last question to close on. Do you foresee jobs being created within the hotel industry for in-house or at least regional positions for persons educated in environmental studies or green solutions and in energy performance of operations? If so, what would these positions be and how would the industry utilize this type of information?
This is Clark. I'll start and then Mark and Tom, you can jump in. But my sense is that especially in the hospitality world, hotel chains and hotel developers and owners are going to have huge value propositions in front of them by delivering different products to the guests that are interesting, engaging, and healthy. And to that end, I think those groups would benefit by having people focused on that world. I think it is probably a nascent job description right now, and it's open to people's interpretation. So people who are entrepreneurial and driven are going to be able to fill that space and invent that position as it's coming into the fore.
I guess I would add an example that's similar to that, and that is what's known as a resource conservation manager. And there are a couple of utilities in the Northwest have adopted these programs where they actually incentivize the building operator to be a resource conservation manager. And what that means is that they actually pay a pretty substantial portion of their salary. It can be as much as $40,000 a year just to have a person in a large building that is paying attention to energy operation and what have you. And they provide training so that this person is a better building manager, but they also tend to be doing outreach with occupants on recycling and green strategies and sustainability writ more large. And from what I understand, these utilities, the ones that have sort of tracked this, they consider it to be their most cost-effective conservation program of anything. And that gets at the idea that, buildings really need a lot of help to run well. There's very few buildings that are really well run in the country today. There's very few buildings that are running at their potential. And so they invest in someone who's on, the utility actually subsidizes the salary of these people to reduce building energy use. And, there's certainly organizations that do that internally as well.
And likewise, on the health side, I would, in addition to what I've spoken to already about the value proposition for creating a healthy building to sell to the potential occupants of the rooms, there's a major occupational health issue at stake here as well, and that blending, working with the building materials, of which I've been speaking of, with cleaning products and other operations materials would be could be very valuable to a hospitality firm, and I think a position that could see immediate benefits in the health of staff as well. And I want to, before we close, I want to make it already in the chat that if you want to reach me after this session, drop the S from the email address that's listed in front of you right now. It's healthybuilding.net, not plural.
Sorry about that, Tom.
No problem. I know you'd like me to get to more buildings than just one, but...
Yeah. So, thanks to everyone. We want to finish on time, and I appreciate everyone staying on the webinar. It looks like we had really solid attendance right to the end. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Yes, thanks to our speakers for sharing their time and their knowledge. And remember, tomorrow's session, the first one is at 2 o'clock Eastern Time, water efficiency beyond low-flow fixtures. Thank you, everyone.